Good morning and welcome to the September 23rd edition of Mountain Money. I'm your host, Roger Goldman. I am here with my co-host, Kevin Kennedy. Good morning, Kevin.
Good morning, Roger. Good morning, Park City.
Today on Mountain Money, author Max Boot is going to join us to discuss his new biography of Ronald Reagan. Then Nathan Rafferty, the president and CEO of Ski Utah, will join us to talk about the upcoming ski season. We'll finish our hour by speaking with Stephen Bowers, CPA, about steps you should consider with respect to taxes as we approach year-end. Given today's divided politics, it's kind of hard to believe that in 1984, Ronald Reagan won re-election by carrying 49 states and the District of Columbia. Reagan was a unique political figure with movie star good looks and a warm and witty public persona. But the private Reagan was far more complex. Author Max Boot takes a deep dive into the life and legend of Ronald Reagan in his new biography. We're very lucky to be joined by him this morning. Okay. So Max, what drew you to the topic of Reagan, and how long did it take you to do the research?
It took me about a decade to do the research, and what drew me to the topic was the fact that Reagan was such a consequential president, so important to the world, and to me personally, growing up in the 1980s. But I felt like when I started this project, there really was not a good Reagan biography out there. And so I felt this was a gap that needed to be filled. And that's what I set out to do over the course of the last decade, trying to write something that was truly objective and balanced, presenting both the good and the bad sides of Ronald Reagan, both his strengths as well as his weaknesses. And so I was very gratified to see that the New Yorker, in their review, said that Reagan is life and legend. Aims to be the definitive biography, and it succeeds. So I had kind of a mission accomplished moment there.
Well, it is a really interesting book. I spent a lot of time with it over the weekend. It's interesting that you had access to a lot of people probably near the end of when many of them who had firsthand experience in the Reagan administration are still alive. And in contrast to Edmund Morris's book, Dutch, you didn't have to make things up.
That's true. I kept it rigorously factual when I didn't. I thought that Edmund Morris was a very skilled writer, but he had some kind of weird breakdown while writing the book, his book, and decided to insert himself as a fictional character. So I resisted that temptation. I mean, I think I kind of wrote this book at a sweet spot where we were far enough removed from the Reagan presidency to be able to have some objectivity about it, to be able to see it in historical perspective, and also to have access to a bunch of documents that have since opened up at the Reagan Library and elsewhere. But at the same time, when I started this book, there were still a lot of people in very senior positions in the Reagan administration and people who knew Reagan very well who were still very much around. And I was able to interview quite a few of them. And sadly, a number of them are no longer with us, people like Colin Powell or George Shultz, Bud McFarlane, or others. But I was lucky enough to speak to them. And I'm sure in the future there will be other historians who will have access to even more documents because new documents open up all the time. But they're not going to be able to talk to the key players as I was able to do.
Yeah, I see. So I've heard that the Reagan Library is kept at a very cold temperature. Did you find that? And if so, what was that temperature?
Yeah, it is. It is very air conditioned, and I assume that's to preserve the documents. But yeah, it's like it doesn't matter how hot it is outside; it's always freezing in there. So yeah, that was just one of the. Small quirks you get used to, and you spend a lot of time just researching there. Although, frankly, the even bigger obstacle for me was just to fight the boredom because, you know, when you're researching a book like this, you wind up going through massive amounts of paperwork, tons of documents, and most of them are excruciatingly boring and just kind of the paperwork that government always generates. So, but you got to stay awake because then, like, every hour or so, you turn to a document, you say, wow, this is amazing, this is interesting, this is something I can use. But then you have to, you know, wade through a lot of really boring stuff to get to the few jewels hidden here and there.
Yeah. Now, could you share a bit about Reagan's youth and how it shaped his political philosophy?
Well, Reagan was really a product of the Midwest. I mean, we think of him as a Westerner because he was governor of California, had a ranch in California, but his personality was really shaped by the small town world of the early 20th century Midwest, and specifically moving around a bunch of small towns in Illinois. His father was an alcoholic shoe salesman who kept losing one job after another, and so the family, you know, had to keep moving. And so little Dutch Reagan, as he was called, you know, knew that he wasn't going to stay in town long enough to really form any real attachments with the other kids. And that began kind of a lifetime habit of erecting this mental fence around himself and really being fairly aloof and not really having any close friends. I mean, there were, you know, a couple of other influences from childhood. One was the fact that his parents, you know, were often in conflict because his father would go off on these multi-day benders and his mother would not be very happy when he returned. And so Dutch Reagan kind of formed a horror of personality conflict, which is a little bit at odds with his image as being somebody who is very confrontational in his politics. But in his personal approach, whether dealing with his kids or aides or others, he really shied away from any kind of personality conflict or confrontation. And the final influence from his childhood was the fact that, you know, his mother, Nellie, who was a very religious lady, was also kind of a frustrated thespian and, you know, put little Dutch and his brother Moon on the stage from a very early age when she was staging plays in these churches and other forums in these small Illinois towns. And so Dutch kind of grew up appreciating being applauded and enjoying the sensation of acting. And so that's kind of what his initial impetus for pursuing an acting career, which eventually morphed into his political career. So he was, you know, really profoundly shaped by this Midwestern childhood.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and sort of going beyond that, from the outside, Reagan sort of seemed like the kind of person whose warmth would result in a close family and lots of deep friendships. But that's not the Reagan you portray in the book. He really seemed kind of cold and distant, wasn't he?
Yeah, no, he was. And that goes, again, back to his childhood habits of not really getting close to the other kids, never really grew close to most other people, with the exception of Nancy Reagan, throughout his life. And yeah, he would kick it off and be pretty oblivious about what was happening around him, because and what I found was that he kind of used his jokes and stories, and he had, you know, an infinite stockpile of jokes and stories, but he kind of used them to keep the world at kind of a safe remove, that he always interacted with people at a very superficial level and didn't really delve deep into who they were or what was going on with them. And so that meant, like, for example, you know, his son Michael was, you know, was sexually molested as a youngster, but, you know, President Reagan didn't find this out until Michael wrote a memoir that came out in the 1980s, and he was equally oblivious to a lot of other things that were going on with his kids or later with his aides, so he could be, you know, kind of strangely aloof from those around him. And in fact, as Jim Baker, his White House chief of staff, said to me, you know, you could never forget with Reagan that we were all just, you know, we loved him and admired him, but we were all just hired hands, and, you know, we could be gone tomorrow and he'd never even notice we had been there.
I want to sort of follow up a little bit with the concept of how his initial political views began to shift in Hollywood and as he became a corporate spokesman. Obviously, this is sort of a seminal sort of moment in the trajectory of his thinking. Can you share a little bit about that?
Yeah, it was really in the 1950s that he became a conservative, after having grown up as a New Deal liberal and somebody who worshipped FDR. By the early 1960s, he was a very right-wing Republican, and the transformation began in the late 40s when he was a labor leader in Hollywood, president of the Screen Actors Guild, and he became active in the battles over communism in Hollywood and became convinced that there was a communist conspiracy to take over Hollywood, which I think was very exaggerated, but that was certainly his mindset. And then in the 1950s, after his movie career cratered, he became host of General Electric Theater, this show on TV on Sunday nights, and became a spokesman for General Electric. And GE in those days was a very conservative company that really propagandized its employees about the virtues of capitalism and free markets, because they saw that as an inoculation against strikes and union activity. And so Reagan, you know, he would take these long train rides from L.A. to New York because he was afraid of flying in those days. And he would have a lot of time to read on the train, and he would read a lot of this literature that GE was foisting on its employees. And that's what really completed his transformation, not just into an anti-communist, but into a very hardcore doctrinaire conservative who was very much a Republican by the early 60s.
Yeah. Now, Reagan's approach, you know, moving on to economics, has had major implications that resonate to this day. Can you talk a bit about Reaganomics and the implications with respect to growth, budget deficits, and income inequality, please?
Yeah, I mean, Reagan was very much a believer in lowering taxes, and And he achieved that. I mean, he raised some taxes, but he certainly lowered personal income taxes, you know, pretty dramatically, with the top rate falling from like 70% to 30%, roughly speaking, during his presidency. And, you know, that had consequences that, you know, he couldn't anticipate. And one of those consequences was that it widened income inequality, because so many of the benefits flowed to the top 1%, and the rest of the country was kind of stagnating or regressing, you know, and those that income disparity was widened further by his anti-union activities and by his failure to enforce antitrust laws. So the result of all of that is, if you look at, you know, income inequality in America, the trend lines really become very divergent in the early 1980s and continue to diverge in subsequent decades. And I think that's kind of had a destabilizing political effect, because it's really fed populism on both the left and the right, whether it was Occupy Wall Street or the Tea Party or now Trump, and it's really decreased faith in our political system and our country. And so that those are consequences that Reagan certainly never intended, but that they certainly flow out of some of those free market policies that he pursued.
And the Reagan administration sort of marks a change in what had been a longstanding belief, I believe, on the right, of the importance of balanced budgets. Did Reagan think that he could still, you know, did Reagan understand that he was creating this kind of long-term deficits by his approach to taxation?
He didn't, because he believed, contrary to all evidence, that he could cut income taxes and the result would be an increase in governmental revenues, because he subscribed to this supply-side notion that that cutting taxes would stimulate the economy and therefore boost federal revenues. Now, this was not true, and there were no mainstream economists who actually believed this, but Reagan believed it. And so, you know, this is why George H.W. Bush denounced Reaganomics as being voodoo economics, because Reagan imagined that he could cut taxes, raise defense spending, and still balance the budget. And obviously that was impossible, and it proved to be impossible. In fact, the budget deficit skyrocketed on his watch. And when he was asked later on about his presidency, pretty much the only regret that he said that he had was that he couldn't balance the budget. But that was basically, you know, kind of the nature of his economics, that the numbers just did not add up.
Yeah. So he, just a moment ago, you mentioned how he was trying to break up some unions. Yet, as an actor, he was a member of the Screen Actors Guild union, and which helped him along his career. That was kind of an interesting choice for him to be anti-union, yet it got him going. That, can you speak to any of that, please?
Yeah, I mean, he later said that, you know, it was a breeze for him to negotiate with Soviet leaders, because he had learned negotiating sitting across the table from studio chiefs in Hollywood. And there was no question that being a union leader, that was really his first brush with the political arena. He became a prominent political player in Hollywood, and even, you know, testified before the House Un-American Affairs Committee in Washington. And so that was kind of his entry into politics. And he was very proud of the fact that he was the only union leader ever to become president. But in you know, by the time he became president, he very much had this hardline free market anti-union mindset. And of course, one of his first notable actions as president was to break the air traffic controllers union when they went out on strike in the summer of 1981. They thought that because PATCO, their air traffic controllers union, had backed Reagan, that he would cave into their demands. And he didn't, and was willing to fire them and take and, you know, replace them at least temporarily with military air traffic controllers, taking a huge risk, because if there had been an airplane crash at that point, he probably would have been blamed, and it would have been a disaster at both a human and a political level. But things more or less worked out, and he established, you know, his toughness basically by taking on the air traffic controllers union. And that was a message that went out around the world. But of course, the consequence of that was also he set a very anti-union trend in the U.S., which led to a decline in union membership and activism in subsequent decades. And again, I think that that helps contribute to this widening in income inequality that we've seen in recent decades.
One of the really interesting things about the book is the way you sort of look at the legend, as you say in the title, versus the reality, and sometimes they line up and sometimes they don't. Reagan is often credited with being the key figure in ending the Cold War. Is that fair?
And he was a key figure in ending the Cold War, but not in the way that his admirers often describe it. There's kind of a legend about Ronald Reagan, which is that, you know, he raised defense spending in his first term. He called out the evil empire. He provided support to the Afghan freedom fighters, and all of that led to the collapse of the Soviet Union. And that's not really what happened. I mean, he did do all those things in his first term, but it really produced was war scares with the Soviet Union. It didn't cause the Soviets to buckle under, and they were not going bankrupt. They could still afford their defense spending. The really transformational moment occurred in 1985 when Konstantin Chernenko died and Mikhail Gorbachev became the leader of the Soviet Union. And Gorbachev was really a black swan, somebody who had risen to the top of the communist system while losing faith in that system. And he launched these wide-ranging reforms that, unbeknownst to him, wound up destroying the Soviet Union. So Reagan didn't cause the Gorbachev reforms and didn't bring down the Soviet Union, but what he did do was he recognized that Gorbachev was a different kind of communist and somebody he could work with, and that was very much contrary to the advice that he was getting from hardliners like his own defense secretary Caspar Weinberger and others, that Reagan really invested in Gorbachev, wanted to help him and work with him to reduce nuclear weapons and reduce Cold War tensions and ultimately to end the Cold War. And so I think that was the ultimate tribute to his pragmatism. It was really his conciliatory second-term approach to the Soviet Union that paid major geopolitical dividends, much more so than his confrontational approach during his first term.
Now, you mentioned earlier that when he was sat on the train, he got to read a lot. And one of the things that I found interesting in the book was his portrayal of Reagan as a voracious reader with a phenomenal memory, which is sort of not sort of consistent with his public image during the time. But I want to sort of tie that into Iran-Contra. Can you talk a little bit about Iran-Contra and what does it say about Reagan's ethics and candor?
Well, Iran-Contra was the biggest scandal, not the only scandal, but the biggest scandal of the Reagan administration. And that occurred as a result of Iran taking, or Iranian proxies like Hezbollah, taking Americans hostage in Lebanon. And Reagan, contrary to his image for being kind of this cold-hearted guy, was actually a very soft touch. And he was deeply worried about the fate of the U.S. hostages. And so that led his aides to implement this cockamamie scheme to sell weapons to Iran to get the hostages released. And they did release a few hostages, but then they took some more. So it was a disaster. But then Reagan's national security advisor, John Poindexter, and Ollie North, who was then an aide on the National Security Council, had a further brainstorm to take the profits from the sale of weapons to Iran and funnel it to the Nicaraguan Contras, these anti-communist guerrillas in Nicaragua. And funding them was contrary to a law passed by Congress called the Boland Amendment. So this was a disaster all around and could have led to Reagan's impeachment. But in some ways, Reagan got into the Iran-Contra mess and got out of it for the same reason, which was that he was so disengaged from the management of government. He didn't really know he claimed not to know what was going on with the diversion of money to the Contras. And, you know, people believed him. I mean, if Richard Nixon had said he didn't know what was going on, everybody would have thought he was lying. But with Reagan, it was actually kind of credible that he didn't realize what his subordinates were up to. So this was kind of the cost the nation paid for a president who was a great leader, but a poor manager.
So he was cold to people close to him, but he had empathy for the hostages and almost turned a blind eye to how he could save them, it sounds like.
Yeah, exactly. He was a man of many contradictions and paradoxes. Yes, absolutely. He was very moved by the fate of the hostages and as he was moved by, you know, the fate of other people that he didn't really know, even while as you say, he was often very cold and distant to the people closest to him.
You know, Reagan is viewed largely as this conservative ideologue, doctrinaire in nature.
But one of the things you talk about in the book that I thought was really interesting was his pragmatism, and you just mentioned it with respect to Gorbachev. Can you give us some other examples from Reagan's career where he demonstrated that while he had the rhetoric of a hardliner, he was often willing to find ways to solutions?
Yeah, no, this was a pretty consistent theme, both of his governorship in California and his presidency in Washington. In both cases, he constantly compromised with Democrats. I mean, in fact, his very first budget as governor of California had massive spending and tax increases, which is the last thing you expect from a conservative Republican. As governor of California, he signed one of the most liberal abortion laws in the country and a very tough gun control bill. And then as president of the United States, he cut taxes on some occasions, but raised them on others. In 1986, he signed a bill that legalized millions of undocumented immigrants, what Republicans would today call an amnesty bill. But, you know, Reagan's whole philosophy was he had nothing but contempt for conservatives who go over the cliff with their flags flying, as he put it. He always believed that he was better off compromising and getting part of what he wanted today and coming back for more tomorrow rather than, you know, being an absolutist and saying my way or the highway. That was not his approach at all. At the end of the day, he was really that kind of Midwestern pragmatist, like the farmer who goes to market and is hoping to get maybe $20 a bushel for his corn. He can only get 10. He says, okay, I'll take it and hope for more tomorrow. So that was very much the Reagan approach.
Now, just getting speculative, do you think if Reagan was around and involved in politics today, do you think he would still be a member of the Republican Party, seeing as how it's going down its road?
Well, I suspect he would be a Republican because he had tremendous kind of tribal loyalty to the Republican Party from 1960 on. But I'm sure he would be very puzzled by the positions that Republicans take today because, remember, Reagan was pro-free trade, pro-immigration, pro-alliances, pro-NATO, pro-standing up to Russia. And he also had a very positive, optimistic vision of America as a shining city on a hill. And he always spoke very movingly about his optimism about America, which is, I couldn't imagine Ronald Reagan describing America as a failing nation as Donald Trump does today.
So how do you think his presidency influences our politics today? I mean, he is often referred to, but it's not clear to me that, you know, the principles that he espoused, the things you've just talked to, are really still alive and vibrant within sort of Republican politics.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's funny that today Reagan is more often cited by Democrats than Republicans because Democrats are always saying, you know, Ronald Reagan would be rolling over in his grave if he could see X, Y, or Z that Republicans are doing today. And I think there's some truth to that, but there's also some continuities. I mean, after all, Reagan, you know, is all about cutting taxes and appointing conservative judges, and those are still things that animate the Republican Party today. He also had a very populist, you know, anti-government attitude. Even when he was leading the government, his rhetoric was very much anti-government, and that's still very much a fixture in the Republican Party. But, you know, in other ways, I think it's fair to say that the Republican Party has gone from being a conservative party in Reagan's day to being more of a nationalist populist party today, and quite different in many ways from the GOP of Ronald Reagan.
You know, I could still hear him saying, I'm from the government and I'm here to help, as some of the scariest words ever uttered. Before we go, last question. In what major ways do you think the mythology surrounding Reagan differ from the reality?
I think there's a lot of mythology. I think we were just talking about the reality of Reagan as a pragmatist, but the legend of Reagan is that he was this hardline ideologue. And I think kind of his genius was that he made room for himself to maneuver and to compromise with Democrats without losing the support of conservative Republicans, in part because, you know, he convinced conservative Republicans that he was one of them, that he really believed what they believed. And that kind of gave him kind of maneuvering room to do deals and compromises. And, you know, other Republican politicians like George W. Bush, Bob Dole, John McCain, Mitt Romney, you know, so many speakers of the House like Mike Johnson or, you know, Kevin McCarthy or so many others, they really haven't had that maneuvering room because the base often, you know, fundamentally distrusts them and doesn't think that they're conservatives at heart in the way that Reagan was. And so, you know, he was able to get away with a lot because the base loved him, and so he was able to compromise in a way that's very hard for other Republican politicians to do.
The book is Max Boot's His Life and Legend.
Reagan. We've been really lucky to speak with Max Boot today. I have a suspicion that this may well be the definitive biography of Reagan that you hope it will be. Thanks for spending time with us this morning.
Really appreciate it. Thanks for having me on.
Okay, we are back. Thank you for staying with us. We have Nathan Rafferty, President and CEO of Ski Utah. Good morning, Nathan. How are you?
Good morning, guys.
Hey, so I know we've all heard the name, Ski Utah. For years, we've heard Ski Utah. What exactly does the organization do for the typical resident? What does it do for the typical tourist? And what does it do for the ski resorts here in Utah?
Great question. So we get that question all the time. Everybody knows the name, but what do we do? We are a 501c6 business association, not for profit, and we really kind of have three pillars where we market skiing to the world, to nationally, a little bit locally, but mostly nationally and internationally. And then we do government relations. So we work with both our state and federal legislators to promote a positive business environment for our resorts and anybody who's doing business in the ski industry, whether it's restaurants, transportation. You know, we work on liquor laws and tax stuff and all sorts of fun stuff.
So you kind of like the Chamber of Commerce for skiing?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, my elevator pitch to people is to tell people we try to get people to come skiing here in Utah instead of Colorado or California or Whistler, or choose skiing over California beaches or Disneyland.
Go ahead, Kevin.
So when I'm sitting on the chairlift, I can meet people from all over the world, and that's thanks to you.
We'd like to think so. It's thanks to a lot of people at the end of the day, but we kind of fly really high and promote greatest snow on earth and easy access. And all 15 of our public resorts here kind of have their own niche and let them sort out who does what best. But, the greatest snow on earth and getting into and out of Utah are real calling cards.
Yeah, let's talk biggest of big pictures. You know, what are the sort of ways in which you try to market? You know, what are the avenues that you choose to try to market Utah as a ski destination?
Right. You know, it's not brain surgery. There is, it's skiing. It's right. It's an easy sell for the most part, but we've gotten increasingly sophisticated with our digital marketing, and we have a great ad agency in Love. Ad agency down in Salt Lake City. It used to be buy full page ads in USA Today and Delta's magazine, and we don't do a whole lot of print these days, but it's amazing how focused and targeted you can be online. So we spend a ton of time doing that, but we also spend way more time than we ever have with social media and creating content. So videos and daily photos and just kind of revving the stoke online, and so we really cover the local market there too.
Nice. So a couple of years ago, winter 22-23 was a fantastic snow year. How did Utah fare, or the Utah resorts and the communities around the resorts, how did they fare economically due to such great snow?
Well, it turns out people like skiing deep powder, and 2 years ago we had plenty of it, so 903 inches of that to be exact, and that equated to then about $200 billion of non-resident visitor spending, overall 2.6, so we divide non-resident spending from our resident spending. Clearly, I mean, it's easy to understand. Somebody who comes from out of state spends significantly more money than somebody does from in state, because they're renting a car, staying in a hotel, eating out, ski lessons, ski rentals, you know, you name it. There's a lot more things you have to spend money on. And so as a local, you grab your skis and you head for the hills and you have lunch or don't have lunch at the resort, and less opportunities to spend money. But that's not to say that locals are any less important to the overall mix of the vibe here in Utah.
Yeah, now let's go to just last year. Mm-hmm. What was that big number for last year?
So interestingly, we still had an above average snow year, although it got off to a little bit of a late start, turned on in kind of mid to late January. And then we had record breaking February, and which is nice timing because February and March are, you know, the meat of the, our season. And that resulted in a slight decrease in skier days. So down to 6.75 million skier days. And that's essentially visits, visits to ski areas. But interestingly, our overall spend was up just slightly to, what was it, $2.65 billion, I think, up from something like $2.63. So spending just slightly up.
Gotcha. And do you have projections for this year? Like if I was saying, hey, I'm going to open a ski resort, Nathan, can your team give me some numbers so I can get some
investors? You know, it's so hard to do. I think we're going to find ourselves in, you know, it's like, I mean, we are at the end of the day snow farmers. It snows or it doesn't snow, that really affects the ski season. We can set everything up just perfectly, and, you know, and if it doesn't snow, we find ourselves in, you know, it's just more challenging. 2 years ago, we had too much snow, and that was equally as challenging. So it can be tricky, but, you know, here in Utah, we're really lucky. We have very consistent snowfall, so typically between 400 and 600 inches of snow. People would love to have our least snowy snow years. If we have average snowfall, I think our kind of happy space is going to be on the upper range of that 6 million skier days. So I would suspect we'd land somewhere between there and 7. You know, things are just getting better in this state. All sorts of improvements. The airport's just so fantastic. They're going to open that new central tunnel in about a month. That'll make things easier. And then, you know, they still have a ton of gates to add. So I think every fall for the next 2 or 3 years, there are going to be significant upgrades at the airport. And then, you know, we have something like 30 lifts. Don't tell me, don't ask me exactly where and when, but 30 new lifts scheduled over the next 3 years in this state. And, you know,
in public resorts.
Yeah. And yeah. A little bit of both.
Okay.
And you know, we used to have a parade when there'd be a new chairlift. These are not inexpensive capital expenditures for ski areas. A brand new high-speed quad is anywhere between $8 and $12 million these days. So, it's not cheap to run a ski area.
Are they all brand new lifts in new locations or replacements?
Oh, it's a total mixed bag.
Okay.
You know, some are fixed grips chairs that are getting replaced by high speed detachable. Some are brand new. But it's, you know, we've never seen anything quite like this kind of surge in infrastructure.
Let's talk a little bit about the rhythm of the year. You know, you mentioned before social media, it's October.
Yep.
Are you starting to promote, and will you sort of react to snowfall? Talk a little bit about how the rhythm of the promotional year goes.
Yeah. Well, in our office and at the ski resorts, winter starts in about mid-August. You know, it just ramps up and gets crazy busy all the way through the fall, where everything that we've been planning all spring and summer are kind of coming into place. Deadlines are needing to be met. And you know, there's really been a shift over the last several decades. You know, I remember, you know, the ski areas used to just kind of flip a switch and turn off for this, you know, and you wouldn't even think about it till Labor Day, right? And then you start thinking about your season pass. Well, most season passes are sold in April and May, way before the ski season even gets started these days. But we'll go as an office, and we take all the resorts with us to New York next week, actually. And we'll go visit, we'll do a couple receptions with influencers and journalists in New York City. And, you know, we're talking snow. I rode my bike up Armstrong and up Pinecone yesterday, and I, you know, saw snow / hail, whatever was left over from the big storm on Saturday. And it felt chilly. It felt good. Mm-hmm. You know, winter's just around the corner.
Yeah, let's go back a little bit and look at Ski Utah as an organization. How long has it been around, and what was the primary purpose for its forming?
It's been around for quite a while, and it was first started as the Utah Ski Association in 1975. I believe the mayor of Alta at the time, Bill Lovett, kind of corralled some of the ski areas, and I'm not even sure what the issue it was, but it was a government relations issue, and they said, hey, we should, you know, this is an issue for all of us. Let's work on this together. Mm-hmm. And then they decided that that worked well, and the resorts played well together. At the time, you know, we didn't have a big footprint nationally or outside of the state in terms of skiing. So they said, hey, let's throw some of our money together and promote skiing as a state. So in 1978, Ski Utah was formed as a really the marketing arm of the Utah Ski Association. We've since combined those two companies for tax reasons and just it was complicated running, you know, two different balance sheets and all that. But, you know, so we're now kind of an amalgamation of both those things. And I think our superpower is that all our resorts work so well together. I can tell you it's not the same in every other state. Mm-hmm. I have a counterpart in Vermont and California and Colorado, and they don't all play as well as we do together here in Utah. And so you see, you know, Cherry Peak talking to Brian Head and Snowbird talking to Alta and Deer Valley and Park City working together on so many issues. So we're really fortunate that, you know, the leaders of all these great resorts work so well together.
So back in 75, they were actually trying to get people to Utahns to hit the slopes and ski. What percentage of Utahns skied back then compared to what percentage of Utahns ski today?
I don't know. That's a great question. Okay. I can tell you what it is today. Back then, I would suspect it was more locally focused. I want to say last year it was 48% Utahns versus 52% out of state. Hmm. That changes only slightly here and there. I think we probably see an uptick of local skiing on the big snow years, for sure. You know, you got a season pass in your pocket. I know I skied a whole lot more 2 years ago in that big snow year. and then we just didn't have the impact or the footprint that we do today.
Nathan, probably last question. The advent of the relatively expensive multi-resort ski pass has really changed the industry. For many of us locals, we would question whether it changed it for the better, but that's a different conversation.
Sure.
Is that model here to stay?
For sure. I think absolutely. I mean, what that does is give our business consistency. And if you're a business owner at all, you know, one of the most important things you want is consistency. And the old model was, you know, if you had a season pass, you were a hardcore local and you were going to ski 20, 30, 40 days a year. Now you buy your season pass in April or May, and that gives the resort the consistency it needs to stay afloat. You know, we live in a world of these huge ski areas, but there are mom and pop ski areas that really need that consistency. And imagine being in Salt Lake City like I was when I was a kid, and you poke your head out the window and you're like, well, I was gonna ski today, but I'm not sure. It looks a little gray. Maybe it's cold. If you got a season pass in your pocket, you're going. And guess, if you take two runs, big deal. But if you know, it used to be where, you know, you had to pony up for a single day lift ticket and you were going to ski, you know, 9 to 4 regardless. It's changed the model, and I think changed the model for better.
Outstanding. Thank you very much. We were listening to Nathan Rafferty from Ski Utah. We'll be back in just a moment. Okay, yeah, we all know that April 15th is tax day, and some of us fear it, some of us try to avoid it, but can we make it any easier by doing stuff now? With us in studio is Stephen Bauer, CPA. Good morning, Stephen.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Indeed. Now, I'm just going to jump into some questions here. Do CPAs work for individual taxpayers or small businesses or large businesses or even joint corporations?
Well, most CPAs and large corporations work exclusively for them, right? In-house counsel, if you will. But yes, CPAs can offer a wide range of services to small business owners, individuals throughout the year.
Good. So if I have a small business, I don't need a CFO or even a controller, just a bookkeeper, and then the CPA does?
Correct. That could help utilize and keep you organized throughout the year to help maximize tax benefits, yes.
good, good. Now, what is the difference between having a huge corporate, besides the money, obviously, a huge corporation and then a whole accounting department compared to having a smaller business and then relying on a third-party CPA like yourself?
Well, like you said, cost is probably the biggest factor, right? So if you have someone in-house, obviously paying larger salaries, but utilizing a local CPA firm, that allows you to save some money outsourcing some of those items, payroll, bookkeeping, et cetera, to just save dollars.
Okay, so as we approach year end, are there things that people should be thinking about with respect to taxes rather than just waiting until January, February, March, or April?
Yes, I love it. Because one of the lines I like to say is, you know, if someone comes to our firm for services on January 1st, at that point, we're just filling out paperwork, right?
Cash.
So when we're getting into that fourth quarter, December, end of the year, that's where being organized, making sure your books and records are in order, looking at your P&L so that way we know what our taxable income is in order to make sure we're making those tax payments through estimated tax payments or through our W-2. So that way we minimize any penalties or interest associated with that.
So as a not-for-profit, we here at KPCW and many other not-for-profits are very dependent, obviously, on donations. With the advent of a few years ago of the large personal deduction, you know, a lot of people don't itemize anymore.
Yeah.
Are there ways in which people can create strategies to allow them to get some benefit of tax deductions through putting multiple years together? Talk to a little bit about what strategies are available.
It's interesting. As we know, tax law changes frequently throughout the years. And here we go with another election cycle coming up in December, so we'll see what happens. But that was very frustrating for a lot of taxpayers when they did decrease allowable contributions. And so we saw a lot less happening throughout those years. They did put some more benefits in place for those contributions, but again, I think seeking a CPA on a monthly or a daily basis to help strategize about that would be more helpful.
Now, one strategy I've heard is for someone to say, look, I've got a mortgage, it doesn't quite get me over the standard deduction, but could I bundle multiple years' contributions in 1 year so that I do much more charitable contributions this year and then very little over the next couple of years so that I get myself over that line so that the marginal contributions are, in fact, deductible. Does that work?
It does. It's all about timing, right? Mm-hmm. So that's, again, where you have to strategize to make sure those items fall in line. Because as a taxpayer, you're a cash-based taxpayer. So you got to make sure those donations fall in the years that you want to maximize those deductions.
Another strategy I heard of along those lines are, let's say this year I'm over the personal exemption. I'm in the land of deductibility, shall we say. not necessarily promised I'm in the land of deductibility. Is that a year in which I could choose to do something like open a donor-advised fund at a Fidelity? Because all my contributions that year are deductible, so I could put some money into that and then spread those contributions over the next few years. The money's gone from me, right? I've gotten my deduction, but then I can send it to my various charitable causes over those years.
Absolutely. That's a great way to, like you said, get around this where you're maximizing your deductions. So seeking that type of advice throughout the year, not waiting to the deadline, is the key. So that is what it's about. We need to be looking in the future and not being reactive.
And now we have to do our disclaimer. This is stuff you really want to talk to somebody about who really knows what they're doing.
Correct. Absolutely.
Listen to the pros. So going off with what Roger was saying, so if I was, if let's say this year I made a whole bunch and I go over the limit, as Rod said, I can open a donor advised fund and then over the next few years donate money to different charities?
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct. Absolutely.
And even though I'm under the within the standard deduction range.
Yes. I mean, again, the purpose of this is funding that, so that way in those years you can maximize the benefits for that contribution.
And just to be really clear, what happens is you give the money in year X. That money's gone from you.
Right.
You got the deduction year X. Mm-hmm. But now that money's sitting over in a Fidelity or a Schwab or a donor advised fund. And when the KPCW pledge drive week comes up, you just call Fidelity and say, hey, Fidelity, I need $100 from my donor advised fund sent to KPCW. So the money's gone from you, but then KPCW gets it, and we appreciate it.
There you go.
That's awesome. Now, what about my 401k, if I had one? Can I fund that now for this year? Can I fund for last year?
So deadlines are April 15th, but if you file an extension, the solo 401k and the SEP IRA, you can fund that up to October 15th, actually with your tax return.
So if I have a solo 401k with my business, I can file until for another I got my extension and I can still contribute. So if I'm having a good year, hey, let's do it.
Correct. Exactly. If you have the cash flow that now you can, for this year, now you can still make the contribution for 2023 to finalize it over these next few weeks.
And I don't know that myself, so therefore I would need a CPA to guide me along that.
Yes, because also you want to make sure you're within your limits and you're maximizing the deduction, because a lot of these calculations are based off the income itself. So you would want to utilize a CPA or a financial advisor to know exactly what that benefit would be or that contribution would be.
And so that sort of leads us into IRAs. Talk a little bit about, you know, IRAs generally and what it is. If you haven't made a contribution for this year, you know, what are the deadlines?
So again, deadline if you have filed the extension is October 15th. And again, maximize those are great for retirement benefits as well. But also advise my clients to make sure that, you know, your cash is sound as well. Because once you put those monies into IRAs, you can't pull that out to 59 and a half. So you don't want to get hit with a penalty. So make sure that you're, you know, consulting and funding those in the years appropriate.
And we're about to get into a conversation that's probably too deep for the amount of time we have left, but can you just talk a little bit about the differences between IRAs and Roth IRAs?
Yeah, so IRAs, Roth IRAs, let's start there. So that's after-tax dollars, right? So that money goes into, you've already paid tax on those dollars. It goes into a fund. Okay, and then as that fund, you know, accumulates interest over time, when you make those distributions, it is tax-free. Okay, a lot of people do not qualify for Roths based on their income limit. So once again, that's a good opportunity to talk to a CPA about how can I qualify. There's some ways to do a backdoor Roth, things of that nature. Traditional IRAs are basically monies that you contribute throughout the year. And again, based on your income will dictate how much of a deduction you will receive based on that. But again, it's a great way to save money for the future. And again, the concept of those are, hey, once your income drops in later years of your life when you're slowing down at work, you can draw from those funds at a lower tax rate. So that is the benefit of putting that money aside.
So, and you can contribute to your IRA or your Roth IRA even if you don't have a 401, you know, you don't have a corporate retirement plan, or if you do have a 401, a SEP IRA, or a simple IRA, you can still do your traditional or Roth IRA contribution. Is that true?
You can, but it might not be deductible based on that other plan. So that plan with your company or the corporation will hold precedence. That's where you'll be getting the deduction from, with deferrals from your salary or inside of your payroll.
So if someone out there listening is a little confused, pick up the phone and call a CPA.
There you go. That's the first step.
That might be doing it. Now, what can I do as a taxpayer right now to get ready for April? Do I grab that shoebox with receipts in it and ship it off to you or, you know, my CPA, whatever? What should I be doing now?
Yeah, I think the key word is being organized, because like you said, the shoebox, we should never have that concept now with where we are with the software we have out there and the ability to stay organized. Because before we even get to the end of the year, we should know where our tax burden is. That way we're not just filing the return. We know exactly what our liability is before we're coming up to the April 15th. So again, being organized, communicating with the consultant throughout the year will help that and also save money, because I have so many clients that scramble at the end and they're missing deductions because they're not organized. So that is probably the key thing, is staying organized throughout the year.
So now is far better than between Christmas and New Year's.
Yes, absolutely.
And you know, as when you meet with clients, particularly ones that are new clients, when you look back over their last few years' filings, what are the biggest mistakes that you see? What are the mistakes you see most often?
That is interesting. Probably just that alone, not maximizing or capturing the expense they have, especially if they own a small business. Mm-hmm. If we're a W-2 employee, there's really not too much we can do, right? We're just filing that 1040. But if you're a small business owner, you have opportunities to maybe purchase equipment at the end of the year or take that accelerated depreciation. But again, making sure you're capturing everything that can help reduce that income.
And I suspect that changes in tax laws keep you very busy. Anything on the horizon we're expecting in the next Congress?
Oh, there's a lot of potential, I would say, bad tax law that could come into play. We're hoping that does not change. But again, as soon as we know, we review all the changes and we look at our clients and see how that affects them directly, and then we make sure we plan accordingly.
I mean, unless something changes, a number of the provisions of the last major tax bill sunset next year, don't they?
A lot of them do, especially when you're getting to estate planning, things of that nature. So that is something to definitely keep your eye on. And some just other tax deductions that they may be taken away from the taxpayer.
And on the estate planning side, the current sort of lifetime or exemption is what, $12, $13 million?
At $15 million per person.
And so if that goes away, what does it drop down to?
Oh, it could go down to $1 million. Who knows how drastic it could change.
Okay.
And that's at the end of 2025?
Correct.
Wow. So if people are thinking about a Roth conversion, getting it done before the end of 2025 might be an idea because we're expecting taxes to go up,
correct,
right?
Correct, yes.
And another sophisticated tax planning strategy would be to choose to die so that you know, in fact, that you get the large lifetime exemption.
And speaking of dying, so therefore, if you had a Roth IRA, you wouldn't have to worry about passing on an inherited IRA to your heirs and them having to deal with RMDs.
There you go.
Well, anyways, we've been speaking with Stephen Bowers, CPA here in town. Steve, thank you very much for coming in.
Thank you, guys.
We'll be with you in just a moment.
Excellent.